Raise your hand for me on this one if you would. Did you go to Starbucks today? And if so, how did you feel about doing it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 18th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with the power of brand loyalty. American consumers, as we have said more than once on this program, can be a fickle bunch. And companies spend in the billions and billions of dollars to make that fickle break their way as best they can, especially in times of crisis. Bloomberg has done the back-of-the-envelope math and figures the half-day shutdown for racial bias training that Starbucks is going to do at the end of May is going to come relatively cheap, about $17 million in lost sales. What's interesting, though, is how Starbucks customers are thinking about what happened in Philadelphia and how they're separating that from the company. Marketplace's Rima Kreis gets us going.
When 43-year-old Alexandra Hernandez heard about the incident in Philadelphia, she thought, that's awful. It's unacceptable.
It just makes me feel like maybe I shouldn't be going to Starbucks.
She says that as she holds a tall caramel frappuccino. But not everyone feels that conflicted. Outside a busy Starbucks in downtown L.A., Alicet Munoz says the baristas there know her by name. She feels comfortable. And the Philadelphia incident does not change that.
And I feel like it was an isolated situation with the manager. The manager might be the racist, not the company itself. So that's not going to stop me from coming to Starbucks.
Walking by the store, I spot 35-year-old Darren Botts. He's holding a coffee cup, too, but it is not from Starbucks.
This is about $2. Starbucks is like $5 or $4 or something like that.
Botts is not a fan of Starbucks, and he says the incident in Philadelphia means he's definitely not going there now.
It shouldn't have happened in the first place, and a mentality that's like that won't be broken with just one day of training.
But organizing such a large public training is a smart move, says Jonathan Bernstein of Bernstein Crisis Management. He gives props to CEO Kevin Johnson.
He comes across as compassionate, as confident, as competent, and with conviction.
Mercedes Davis, a spa owner from Cleveland, Ohio, says she never saw the company at fault for the incident.
That's not part of their culture, I'll say. They're one of the few companies that I can recall going to, and you see diverse people, ages, background, gender, race, whatever, that are actually loving what they do.
And she says she's boycotted companies before, like H&M, after it featured a young black boy in a sweatshirt with a slogan involving a monkey.
I think that was done in extremely poor taste.
And she says unless Starbucks as a corporation messes up in that kind of big way, she'll keep on enjoying her salted caramel mochas. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Full disclosure, by the way, my hand is up. I went today. All right, you remember last week when the Economic Press, President Company included, got a bit spun up by those reports President Trump wanted to get the United States back into the Trans-Pacific Partnership? All right, maybe not quite spun up, but definitely not cynical enough about how Mr. Trump feels about the multilateral trade deal the Obama administration negotiated, because sure as Twitter only lets you use 280 characters, last night he let us know he still doesn't like the TPP and that he thinks bilateral trade deals are more efficient and profitable. Those are his words, efficient and profitable. Our word is, really? Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer.
In trade agreements, there is strength in numbers. If countries band together in a multilateral trade pact, they can set high standards for membership. Countries that want in have to jump through some hoops. Phil Levy is with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs.
If you make a nice enough club, others want to come on in and join. And then they're willing to undergo the initiation rituals.
We're not talking hazing. It's just, here's what you have to do if you want to be one of us. For example, China had to comply with a lot of rules to join the World Trade Organization. It had to accept limits on the tariffs or duties it could charge on imports. Matt Gold is a former U.S. trade negotiator now at Fordham University.
China agreed to a ceiling on every duty for every one of 8,000 types of products entering China.
Gold says Beijing also agreed to allow foreign companies to offer services like banking and insurance in China, all because it wanted to be one of the cool kids in the WTO. Wendy Cutler, another former trade negotiator, is now vice president at the Asia Society Policy Institute. She says everybody in a multilateral agreement plays by the same rules, And that's an advantage for businesses that want to export.
And they know with certainty that they can expect the same rule in country A as in country B as in country C.
Cutler says bilateral agreements between the U.S. and just one other country have their own regulations, forming a patchwork that exporting businesses have to navigate. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Speaking of bilateral trade agreements, President Trump continued his meetings with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe today at Mar-a-Lago. Trade was the topic du jour, about which the president had this to say, quote, "This is a very exciting meeting for me because I like this maybe the best. I love the world of finance and the world of economics," the president went on, "and probably it's what I do best." End of quote. Wall Street today, definitely not best. It was fine, meh, getting by. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Goldman Sachs reported pretty nice profits this week, and yet the company's stock, ticker symbol GS, by the way, shares fell after Goldman said it's not going to be buying back shares in the second quarter. And in that respect, at least, Goldman's a bit of an outlier, because since the new tax code took effect at the beginning of the year, American companies have been using spare cash to repurchase their own shares with some degree of haste. From KUT in Austin, Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
2018 is expected to be a crazy year for stock buybacks, totaling more than $500 billion.
It's an unprecedented number of buybacks.
That's Winston Chua at TrimTabs, a company that monitors stock buybacks. At the end of last year, the biggest companies in the U.S. were sitting on the largest cash pile in history, and they had to do something with it. Jared Bernstein is the senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
And in fact, they've been doing share buybacks for a long time, but with the windfall of the tax cut, that process has hugely accelerated.
PepsiCo, Wells Fargo, Visa, and Google's parent company Alphabet have all announced stock repurchases this year. Even Warren Buffett, who has been against buybacks for decades, says he's thinking about it this time around. Chua at TrimTab says the reason companies do it is, well, pretty simple.
When there's fewer shares in the market and the same amount of earnings, that means each remaining share is worth more.
Which means that company shareholders immediately make money, and they won't have to pay taxes on that stock until they sell it. And those executives, who also have a bunch of stock options, see the bonuses too. Bernstein at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says shareholders in companies that haven't bought back stock are left scratching their heads.
As an investor, you definitely have an expectation that some of this tax cut-induced profitability should be shared with you.
Proponents of the buybacks say it's a smart thing to do with the idle cash, in part because buybacks do tend to increase share prices. But others argue they only benefit wealthy shareholders and company executives. In fact, Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin introduced a bill in March that would limit the ability of corporations to repurchase their own shares. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Rima was talking up at the top of the program about brand loyalty, Starbucks in that instance. But there is another company in this economy that's banking on its brand and market penetration to keep it out of too terribly much trouble, Facebook by name. CEO Mark Zuckerberg said last week on The Hill that some, not a lot, but some of its users have been turned off by the Cambridge Analytica thing. Interestingly enough, though, Instagram, a company that Facebook bought in 2012, has largely managed to avoid the guilt by association. Sarah Fryer covers technology from Bloomberg, including most recently about whether Instagram might be able to save Facebook from its latest crisis. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So look, if I went out on the street and I stopped, let's say, 10 people, 10 social media users, how many of them do you think know that Instagram is owned by Facebook?
Oh, maybe just a handful. It's not quite a secret because Facebook does promote Instagram as a property in conversations where it's very convenient for them, like in conversations with advertisers. But for consumers, it really benefits Instagram to have this very separate brand.
So let's dig into that a little bit. When Mark Zuckerberg spent $700-something million to buy Instagram a number of years ago, Instagram, by its founder's own admission, was not a very sophisticated company, right? They were just kind of winging this whole growth thing. And then Zuckerberg came in and basically said, do it the Facebook way and grow, baby, grow, right?
Right. Basically, what makes Facebook tick, the reason that Facebook has more than 2 billion users, is because they have this growth team that is just obsessed about getting things in the hands of people who don't have Facebook yet and making sure that they spend more and more time on the site, as much time as possible. And that's really what Facebook is driven by. And Instagram definitely benefited from some of that. But, you know, I also want to mention how different the product is. Mm-hmm. There's no share button on Instagram.
Right, right.
There's no way to really go viral there in the same way that you can on Facebook. So a lot of the problems that Facebook's seen in its growth, Instagram has been able to avoid, kind of like the version two of Facebook.
Yeah, I don't want to make it sound all sunshine and light, but Instagram has been able to, I guess, isolate itself from a lot of the more malign things that have contaminated Facebook. Is that a fair way to put it?
I think, you know, I say in the story, you know, they have their problems. There's some unsavory content, but it's a footnote in the conversation about Facebook's faults. Facebook is just much more what people use to talk about politics, whereas for Instagram, it's much more about culture. And I think that Instagram has been able to kind of stay in the background.
Do you think it's possible that Instagram winds up being the reputational savior for Facebook at some point?
I think that people are starting to recognize the fact that Instagram is part of Facebook. And one of the things that happened in testimony last week with Mark Zuckerberg was that the executive was asked, you know, what is the private sector alternative to Facebook? Is there a private sector alternative to Facebook? And then a follow-up question from Senator Lindsey Graham was, why did you buy Instagram? And Zuckerberg's answer was, well, they're really great app developers, which, of course, is not the reason that Facebook bought Instagram. And so I think, I hope that my story helps people understand that these are one and the same, and that the data that you share on Instagram is then in turn used to target you with ads on Facebook and vice versa. I do hope that consumers understand that these are products owned by the same company.
Sarah Fryer covers technology for Bloomberg. Sarah, thanks a bunch.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up.
It started with those family times in my backyard.
And that is how empires are built. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. On this Wednesday, Dow Industrial's off 38 points, a 10%, closed at 24,748. The NASDAQ gained 14 points, about a 10%, 72.95. S&P 500 rose 2 points, less than a 10%, 27.08. Amazon clicked up 1.5% today. The online retailer struck a deal with Best Buy, making the electronics chain the exclusive brick-and-mortar outlet for Amazon's Fire TVs. Best Buy turned up 3.6% on that. Roku, which has had a deal with Best Buy, slumped 11.8% today. Oops. Rising oil prices pushed energy stocks up, and Anadarko Petroleum surged 3.5%. Hess added 2.8% today. Chevron grew about 1.9%. Crude oil, by the way, up 2.9% today, $68.47 a barrel, which is getting back up there. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.87%. You're listening to Marketplace. Just as you count on Marketplace for reliable, in-depth news and information, we are counting on listeners like you to invest in what we do. The more people who support Marketplace, the more we can do to raise economic intelligence across this country. You'll reap the rewards every time you listen, knowing that you're helping Marketplace make people smarter about the economy and why it matters. And don't forget, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar when you give today, thanks to a generous challenge from our friends at Candida. Now's the time, folks. Go to Marketplace.org and make a gift to become a Marketplace investor today.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're about 7.5 months past Hurricane Irma and the damage it did to parts of Florida, the Florida Keys in particular. Except really, the Keys aren't past the damage. Yes, spring break was busy and good for the businesses that have been able to reopen there, but tourism is one thing, living there permanently is another. And as WLRN's Nancy Klinginer reports, the locals are still living with Irma's aftermath as daily reality.
On Big Pine Key, Bill Tubbs is spending a lot of time working on his garden.
Otherwise, I'd want to put my fist through a wall, and considering this is a concrete block, that would be really painful and it wouldn't hurt the wall.
Tubbs says he's frustrated because more than 6 months after Hurricane Irma, he and his family are still basically camping out in their own house. They have a rigged-up sink and some electricity. The walls are down to studs. The county's tourism agency has spent millions to promote the islands and assure visitors that they should return. In the Keys, tourism provides more than half the jobs. But that message is hard for some residents, like Tubbs.
I think people are, at least in Big Pine, are getting tired of hearing how the Keys have recovered and everything's going great, and it's not for a lot of us.
The county initially found his ground-level home was more than 50% destroyed, which would have meant rebuilding and elevating his home to meet current codes. Tubbs appealed that judgment because he thought it was below the 50% threshold. But he just got a letter calling his property substantially damaged, which means he might have to elevate the concrete block house after all. That would cost a lot more than the repairs he was planning on making.
I feel like we're taking a step forward, and we get pushed 2 steps back.
Fewer than 200 households in the Keys are still living in FEMA housing. Others are improvising, like Tubbs and Patrick Garvey, who also lives on Big Pine Key. He's installing a fence around his 2-acre property called Grimmel Grove.
It's a major accomplishment.
For a lot of property owners, installing a fence is no big deal. But for Garvey, getting Grimmel Grove secure is a big step to getting past Hurricane Irma and reuniting his family. Garvey spent the last 4 backbreaking years restoring the land to grow tropical produce and trees to sell.
I had some different ventures going on with the property that was hoping to create a little income stream, and that was lost.
Now he's working as a tree broker, finding trees on the mainland to sell to people in the Keys who want to replant their yards, and working to get Grimmel Grove up and running again.
The storms definitely made me reconsider certain things in life, priorities in life. It's pretty tough to be away from your wife and kids for as long as I have been.
Garvey's wife and twin 4-year-old daughters were visiting family in Brazil when Hurricane Irma hit. And they're still there, while Garvey is living in a camper on the property.
I can't be doing that forever, but right now I have nowhere else to live. So technically, I guess I'm technically homeless.
Stephanie Capel is head of a coalition of nonprofits that formed to help people recover from the storm over the long term.
That does not happen overnight. It doesn't happen in weeks or months. This is going to take us years.
Since October 1st, when the Keys officially reopened for tourism, the amount of lodging taxes collected is down by about 20% compared to the year before. Local governments in the Keys have spent almost $150 million so far cleaning up after Hurricane Irma. From Big Pine Key, Florida, I'm Nancy Klinginer for Marketplace.
In a lot of restaurants in this country, Maine lobster is the luxury version of a luxury product. You get it in places with white tablecloths and shiny silverware and lots of melted butter. But actually, in Maine, where cousins Jim Salikas and Sabin Lomak grew up, lobster was eaten off paper plates at family picnics in Jim's backyard. 6 years and a couple of appearances on Shark Tank after the cousins sold their first Maine lobster roll off a food truck here in Los Angeles, they now have a national lobster franchise, 20 trucks in 13 cities, and a couple of brick-and-mortar restaurants as well. Their new book about turning one food truck into a multi-million-dollar business is called Cousins Maine Lobster. Guys, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
I need you, Sabin, I guess, just because I'm picking on you first.
Oh, jeez, I knew that's how it was going
to
go.
I want you to tell me about summer times and lobster bakes in Jim's backyard back in Maine.
Yeah, it brings a smile to my face with the question. I don't think we knew how special those times were at the moment when we were growing up. You know, family kicking back, relaxing, having fun. I think when you separate yourself and you move. I moved to Los Angeles. Jim's in Boston. You grow up. All of a sudden, you look back and you go, wow, those times were so special.
So here's the thing about Maine in this book, and I get that that's the name of the company, and you know, it's on the cover of the book. Maine, Jim, is a character in this book.
It is.
How come?
Well, because it's at our roots. It's where we're from. It's what we're all about. It started with those family times in my backyard. But the state of Maine itself is really the foundation of our business. You know, there's two things going on in Maine. There's tourism and there's the lobster industry.
Yeah.
And for so long, the lobster industry, you know, they were considered like the cockroaches of the sea. The lobster lobster was fed to prisoners. But now it's this delicacy that's kind of the crux of our business and how we started. So the history of Maine and that evolution of the industry itself is a critical part of how we grew.
How much, Sabin, is it a competitive advantage for you guys that fundamentally you're Maine insiders? Because one of the things you learn reading this book is that Mainers don't take kindly to outsiders. And so you know the lobstermen. I mean, you've been there.
Yeah, I think it's a huge part of our story and our competitive advantage. And I think we're very, very proud of it. So once we opened, we knew that we wanted to really boast about where we're from, which is why we put it in our name, Cousins Maine Lobster. It was done on purpose. We wanted everyone to know that our product comes directly from Maine and that we're from Maine.
There's a question to be asked here about the lobster industry, right? Because it is fundamentally stuck in time. I mean, not only are you pulling these prehistoric things out, but Maine lobster is controlled and it's outsider averse, it's risk averse, right? I mean, it's all of those things. And I think that contributes to the mystique of this company in a little ways anyway.
Yeah, for sure. It's a hard product to get. It's a wild caught product. It's not anything you can just produce by the thousands or hundreds of thousands. There's only so many licenses for lobstermen in Maine. It's like almost a 15 to 18 year wait list now to become a lobsterman. So to be able to be tapped in with those guys, to own wharfs or buying stations, to control your supply and really have it traceable back to those boats, it's a long process, and it's who you know and how you get in there.
Can we talk about lobster roll for a minute? I've never been a fan. I think they're overrated. I just have to say that. I know. I just have to say that.
It's a good thing there's this big desk separating us right now.
Sell me, man. Sell me.
Well, lobster rolls are inherently, they were called lazy man lobster because people who didn't want to pick and sort out of the lobster, they were leftovers from the lobster bake. And it wasn't something five star when we grew up. It's tradition in each and every bite.
Kai, do you like steamed lobster? Do you like lobster at all?
Wait a second, you don't even like lobster.
Yeah,
lobster is not my go-to when I've got my choice of delicacies.
Uh-huh.
I just happen to think lobster roll specifically is kind of eh.
Jeez.
But I'm bringing my objectivity to the
interview.
Hey,
we appreciate
you guys,
honesty. We love honesty.
See,
cards on the table.
Yeah,
how different is this business you guys are running today, which is in the millions of dollars with franchisees and trucks and actual locations? How different is it from what you thought it would be, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things we say in the book that is certainly very true now, when we had one truck and we were on it and we were there talking to customers or our staff and managing it, we were doing our passion and our love.
Yeah.
Once you want to grow and scale, you remove yourselves and you kind of change your jobs in the sense of managing this whole operation. So,
right.
So our roles change a bit.
You make your franchisees go out on lobster boats, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Why?
Well, we realized we had opened our first 10 franchisees, and they were successful. They had lines, and they appreciated the product. But no matter what we can tell you in text and writing, there's nothing like actually going on a boat, catching a lobster, and throwing 9 out of 10 back for the sustainable measures. And seeing the city that we grew up in, seeing how small it actually is. So now we make it mandatory for all of our new franchisees before you join the system. And their takeaway is so much more profound.
How much of this story, Sabin, is about childhoods lost, right? I mean, you guys trying to get back there. And it's funny now, you live in L.A., you're all over the place, and you're the defining ethic is summertime in Maine.
It's exactly our story. The fun part about working together, the fun part about owning your own business is you get to create the guidelines. And what we've created is something fun. And that's what the lobster bakes at home were. It's nothing fancy, but it's just really a lot of love, and it's really cool.
Definitely nostalgia and wanting to get back to Maine, the lobster tour in Maine. That resonates with a lot of our customers and ourselves.
It's a book and a company called Cousins Maine Lobster. Sabin Lomak and Jim Salikas. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back. This final note on the way out today, call it a marketplace public service announcement. Those of you who leave your taxes to the last minute, you know you got an extra day, right, till midnight tonight because of the IRS's computer mishap yesterday. Speaking of which, Government Tech Infrastructure Week would be a good idea, huh? Also, though, this reminder that I saw in the Washington Post, now that you're filed, remember the new tax code is going to be reflected in the returns you file next April, so the IRS has a handy-dandy withholding calculator you can use to figure out how best to prepare your finances. We'll have a link to it on our website, which does, yes, I know, assume the agency's computers are up and running. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials off 38 points today, a 10%. NASDAQ gained 14 points, about a 10%. S&P 500 rose 2 points, less than a 10%. Pretty calm, relatively speaking, given recent events on Wall Street. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Josta, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a good evening, everybody. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.